one of the problems with teaching multiple sections that I never remember where we are, because it's not always exactly the same in each section. I did get to this slide, right? And I pretty much finished it, as I recall. Okay, cool. Let's go on then to slide 6. We're looking at two cells here to point out a dichotomy as far as cell type is concerned. A dichotomy is a two-part way of looking at something. So what I mean by this, as far as a dichotomy of cell types, is that there are two kinds of cells in the world. I'm talking about biological cells, not jail cells or anything like that. There are cells that are called prokaryotic cells, and those that are eukaryotic. Now, the karyo part of that word is from a root karyon, which means kernel or the core of something. In terms of a cell, the kernel or the core is the nucleus, if the cell has one, the cell nucleus. And not all cells do. And the original cells didn't. That evolved later. Pro means before. So prokaryotic literally means before the nucleus came into existence evolutionarily. And the EU, pronounced U prefix, in eukaryotic means good or true. So eukaryotic literally means having a true nucleus. And that is the basis for the linguistic distinction of these words. It is true that prokaryotic cells do not have a nucleus, and it's true that eukaryotic cells do. But that's not the only difference. That's just the basis for the difference in their names. A nucleus, a cell nucleus, if a cell has one, is an example of an organelle. Remember, we talked about the hierarchy of biological organization last time, and organelles is one level in that hierarchy, right? A nucleus is an example of an organelle. But more specifically than that, a nucleus is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. And that, since that's the first time I've used that phrase, let me tell you that there is a difference between the phrases membrane-bounded and membrane-bound. And I've seen this incorrectly in textbooks even. But since I'll be using both of the phrases eventually, I want to tell you the distinction. Membrane bounded means enclosed by a membrane. Bounded is the past tense of bound. Bound means to form a boundary around. Okay? So membrane bounded is another phrase for enclosed by a membrane or membrane enclosed. Membrane bound, on the other hand, uses the word bound, which itself is the past tense of bind, meaning connect to. And so later on we'll talk about membrane-bound proteins, for instance. A membrane-bound protein is not enclosed by a membrane. It's not membrane-bounded. It is tied to part of a membrane. It's membrane-bound. So just be aware of that. But a nucleus is a membrane-bounded organelle. It's more specifically than just being an organelle. And only eukaryotic cells have membrane-bounded organelles. The nucleus is just one. That's the basis for the name eukaryotic. But a eukaryotic cell has other membrane-bounded organelles that we'll talk about, things like endoplasmic reticulum and so on. Well, a prokaryotic cell not only doesn't have a nucleus, it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. Now, we'll talk a lot more about the structure of membrane material a little bit later. But Membrane material is about the same stuff, whether it is part of a membrane-bounded organelle or whether it's part of the plasma membrane that every cell has, which really defines that cell itself. It's the boundary. The plasma membrane is the boundary between the cell and the rest of the universe. It's what makes it a little test tube. It's what encloses the cell. So every cell, by definition, has a plasma membrane. A prokaryotic cell has a plasma membrane, and that's the only membrane. A eukaryotic cell has its own plasma membrane, but it also has membrane material that encloses other kinds of subcellular, smaller-than-cell structures that we call membrane-bounded organelles, including a nucleus. Is that all clear? We can see that in this picture. The much larger of these two cells is a eukaryotic cell. You can see its plasma membrane as the overall boundary of the whole cell. The purplish region is the cell nucleus, and it's a true nucleus, hence eukaryotic cell, because it's enclosed by its own membrane. It's a membrane-bounded organelle. And that membrane that encloses the nucleus is called the nuclear envelope. The bacterium that's next to this eukaryotic cell is an example of a prokaryotic cell. Bacteria are prokaryotes. If we change this into a noun by taking off the T-I-C and just have it T-E, prokaryote and eukaryote are corresponding words meaning organisms that have prokaryotic cells or eukaryotic cells. We are eukaryotes. But anyway, a bacterium is a prokaryote. Prokaryotes, by the way, are unicellular. Eukaryotes can be either unicellular or multicellular. We are obviously multicellular eukaryotes. But whether it's a bacterium or an archaean, which we'll talk about later, that's also an example of a prokaryote, all prokaryotes are made up of a cell that has only one membrane, namely the plasma membrane that defines the cell itself. There is no true nucleus or anything else enclosed by its own membrane inside the cell. You can also see that there's typically a pretty drastic size difference between a prokaryotic cell and a eukaryotic cell. Just as a rough average, a typical prokaryotic cell is about 10 times smaller than a eukaryotic cell in each of the three dimensions. Therefore, when you consider it, its volume, it's 10 cubed times bigger. A eukaryotic cell is 10 cubed times bigger, or 1,000 times as big. You could fit 1,000 bacteria in a typical eukaryotic cell. This is why, you know, your 100 trillion cells, I don't remember whether I mentioned this to you last time, your 100 trillion cells that you call yourself, that you call your body, those are the cells that you own in a sense, because they have your DNA. But even though 100 trillion is a hell of a big number, for every one of your cells, there are between 10 and 100 bacteria living in and on you. So you're vastly outnumbered by bacteria in this space that you call yourself. But they are much smaller, and so it makes sense that it can happen. We'll study the particulars of organelles in detail in its own chapter, but while we're still on this, let me just say that since eukaryotic cells have membrane-bounded organelles, that means they are compartmentalized. A prokaryotic cell has one compartment because it has only that one membrane, the plasma membrane that is its outer boundary. And therefore, there's only one compartment inside it. All of that stuff inside a prokaryotic cell collectively is called the cytoplasm. Now, cyte or cyto means cell, and plasma means stuff, so it literally means cell stuff. A eukaryotic cell has a cytoplasm as well. But for a eukaryotic cell, the cytoplasm isn't everything inside the cell, because a eukaryotic cell has multiple compartments by virtue of having these multiple membrane-bounded organelles. For instance, the nucleus, which is membrane-bounded, is a separate compartment compared to the stuff that's inside the cell still, but outside of the nucleus, right? Because there's a membrane between those. And so the stuff that's inside a eukaryotic cell's nucleus is called not cytoplasm, but nucleoplasm, the stuff of the nucleus. And the stuff that's inside the eukaryotic cell but outside of the nucleus is called the cytoplasm. The nucleus, by the way, is where we find the DNA in a eukaryotic cell. Well, it's not just eukaryotic cells that require DNA. All living cells require, well, all cells that want to continue living for a while need DNA, including bacteria or any other prokaryotic cell. So they have DNA for the same reasons we do, but they don't have that DNA in its own membrane-bounded compartment, the nucleus. There is no nucleus. But it's not, the DNA is not just distributed randomly throughout the entire cytoplasm of a prokaryotic cell. It is in one concentrated region, usually, within a prokaryotic cell. And we call that place the nucleoid. So you should be careful with that word. The oid suffix means like, right? A humanoid is not a human, it's like a human. A nucleoid is like a nucleus, but it's not a true nucleus because it doesn't have its own membrane. It's just the region in the cytoplasm in a prokaryotic cell where you find the DNA. Okay, let's go to 7. Well, last time I think I mentioned cell theory, didn't I? What did I say the important thing that cell theory tells us is? Right. Cells, at least nowadays, and it's been this way for billions of years, don't just pop into existence. Cells come from pre-existing cells. And usually that's because there is cell division, which we'll study later, meaning one cell that already exists splits into two cells. That's where those two cells came from, the cell that split. And so that cell division results in a proliferation or a greater number of cells, right? This is how you grew from one zygote to 100 trillion cell individual. But it's also true that the zygote that you started with came from pre-existing cells. It's just kind of an exception to that splitting mechanism. Instead, it's a fusion, right? The zygote that you started out it as came from two different cells, one from each of your parents, a sperm from your father and an egg from your mother. The sperm is really just a delivery device for the DNA that it's carrying, but it delivers that DNA to the egg, and when that happens, it's no longer an egg. It's a zygote, or fertilized egg. All right, so that's instead of cells, two cells splitting, two cells fuse in that case, but it's still the case that the zygote came from pre-existing cells, so it still obeys cell theory. As soon as that's done, though, or shortly after that's done, you don't stay a zygote very long. It's only officially a zygote when it's still one cell. For us, that is quickly followed by cell division, so that the zygote becomes two cells, and then each of those split to become 4, 8, and it doubles each time. And then you're an embryo, and eventually you'll become a fetus if everything goes correctly, and then a child. Okay. 8. Well, this is the most famous molecule in the world nowadays, DNA. We haven't known about it, anything about it really, for really all that long. A long time in terms of your lifespan, but in terms of human history, we've only recently known about this thing, and we've learned a lot about it since then. We are going to spend half of the term about DNA, us learning about DNA, the second half of the term, but now I just want to introduce it as an important molecule and tell you its two major functions. Now, I mentioned that I think last time a little bit about this. A lot of people say that DNA gives organisms their traits. Did I say this? Which is not directly true, right? Why is it not directly true? Right. The proteins that an organism is able to produce are what directly give that organism its traits. But no organism of any kind is able to construct a protein unless it's told how to by building that protein, which is a polymer of amino acids, one amino acid at a time, linking them together. It has to know which amino acids to use. It has to know what sequence to put them together to make a protein, and therefore it needs instructions. And the instructions are originally in the form of DNA. Now, it's a two-step process to produce a protein, which we'll study later. Let me just tell you that those two processes are called transcription and translation. And they happen in that order, transcription first and then translation. DNA is involved, of those two, in only translation. It's not involved in transcription, sorry. It's not involved in translation, which is when the protein is actually built. Transcription uses the code that's in DNA to build another similar molecule called RNA that is now carrying the code. DNA's job is done. And then RNA tells the cell specifically how to build the protein. But without the DNA originally, it wouldn't be able to do that. So there are two major functions to DNA in any organism, one of which is transcription. That's the informational, that's a protein-building informational role that DNA serves. Throughout the lifetime of the organism, whether it's one cell or many-celled organisms, you continuously have to make proteins for various jobs. Proteins do just about all the important jobs in cells, which is why they give you your traits. And so we're always building proteins to replace old ones or just to build brand new ones. We need the DNA to do that. What is the other function of DNA, would you guess? Well, we use it for identification forensically. Yeah, is that what you mean? That's true, but I mean that's not a physiological function of DNA. What else is DNA good for in terms of biology? Don't overthink this.
Would it be like molecules attracting each other?
I don't really know what you mean by that, but
I don't either. But I was thinking like molecules like attract each other. Maybe that has something to do with attraction.
Well, it. Let me just say no. But I appreciate the attempt. Well, where did your DNA come from? There's your answer. The second job of DNA is called replication. DNA has the remarkable property of being able to serve as a code for how to build itself, another copy of itself. So you can call it replication or self-replication, but it means duplicating the molecule. And this is absolutely essential to passing on DNA. When you think back to what I said is usually the case for creating new cells, which is cell division. If a cell divides into two cells, now there are suddenly two cells and the original cell no longer exists, right? But if those two cells that are created have any hope of living for a long time, or creating proteins, each of those two cells needs its own set of DNA. It's not good enough to have just half of the DNA of the original cell, because that's only half of the instruction manuals for how to build the proteins. The other half of those proteins have to be built too. So each of the two cells needs a full library of instruction manuals so that each cell can build all of the necessary proteins it needs to live. Therefore, a cell could not split into two successful viable cells. Viable means that they're able to live. Unless the genome, which is the complete library of DNA in the cell, is able to first be copied. So in preparation for cell division, before the splitting happens, a cell has to use DNA's remarkable ability to copy itself, so that for the moment that cell has actually twice as much DNA as it needs, but then it's going to split and give one of the copy to each of those two cells so that they have a complete genome each. All right, so those are the two jobs of DNA. Transcription, which is the first part of building proteins, and replication. And notice that transcription is all about using DNA for the lifetime of that cell or that individual if it's a unicellular organism. DNA gets transcribed throughout the lifetime of a cell so that the proteins can be made. But the replication aspect is really between generations. When a cell is about to end its own life and become two new cells, that's when the replication comes in. And that's how it's passed on. That's why cells can come from pre-existing cells and still live, and that's why each of us is just the latest in a 4 billion year long sequence of cells creating new cells, since those first cells that we all came from. While we're still here, I'll tell you that DNA, which we'll study in much more detail later, is an example of a nucleic acid. That's one of four categories of biological macromolecules that we will study. Nucleic acids is one of four. Macromolecules simply means big molecules. Well, they're small from our point of view, but compared to run-of-the-mill molecules like water, for instance, or oxygen molecule, they're big macromolecules. And all living organisms are made out of the same four categories of biological macromolecules, one of which is nucleic acids. Anyone know what the other three are, since I'm mentioning this? We'll study them in detail later.
Proteins?
Proteins is one. Nucleic acids and proteins, what else? Two more. What is it? Enzymes are examples of proteins. All enzymes are proteins, but not all proteins are enzymes.
Carbohydrates
is an answer I frequently get, but I'm glad you said this, because it's technically not correct. Some people will tell you it is correct, but I'm telling you why they are wrong. Carbohydrates is a big group of molecules, only some of which are big. For instance, glucose, we'll study glucose, is a carbohydrate, but it's not a macromolecule. On the other hand, there are things like starches that are carbohydrates. Plus, they're big, so they are also macromolecules. Therefore, if you list the four macromolecule classes, you shouldn't say carbohydrates, but you should give the name of just the big carbohydrates, the macromolecular carbohydrates, and the name for that is polysaccharides. So that's three. And anyone know the fourth? Those are not, that's what I was just saying. Those are not macromolecules. Monosaccharides are just one-piece sugars. And you use those by hooking them together to build polysaccharides, which is one of the three macromolecular classes. The other is lipids. And so, one by one, we'll go, there's a chapter dedicated to these that we're getting to pretty soon. Anyway, nucleic acids is one of those four. DNA and RNA, similar molecules but importantly different, are both nucleic acids. Why are they called nucleic acids?
They're big molecules.
Well, what part of that phrase means big? No, it doesn't mean big. And also, they're not the only big molecules. Proteins are big. Nucleic means found in the nucleus. Well, of course, that's true only for eukaryotic cells. Prokaryotic cells have DNA as well, like I said, but we called these things originally nucleic acids because that's where you find DNA in a eukaryotic cell, in the nucleus. Now to 9. Time now to talk about feedback. There are two major feedback mechanisms found in living things. You can see here that they are called negative feedback and positive feedback. Only one of these is involved in homeostasis. You remember what I said homeostasis is? Maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment, right? Keeping things livably nice is what homeostasis really is. Well, only one of these two feedback mechanisms has a possibility of maintaining homeostasis. And that is negative feedback. Okay, so all homeostatic feedback mechanisms are negative feedback mechanisms. And therefore, negative feedback in living organisms drastically outnumber positive feedback. There are some positive feedback mechanisms, but not nearly as many as negative feedback. Okay, so I do not want you to think that negative feedback works for homeostasis in one direction and positive feedback works for homeostasis in the other direction. That's entirely wrong. Positive feedback never leads to homeostasis, and just the opposite, actually. Okay, so to make sense of this in terms of what their names are, I first of all need to tell you that a feedback mechanism involves a variable of some sort and a set point. Now, there's all kinds of examples of homeostasis that occurs in cells. There's all kinds of variables that get homeostatically controlled, that is. One of the easiest to understand in everyday life is thermostasis, maintenance of temperature. Thermostasis is just a specific example of homeostasis, in other words. But even non-biologically, this is even easier to understand. Thermostasis of a room, right? You have a thermostat to control the temperature in a room. Well, you set that thermostat at some specific temperature that you want the room to be at, right? That's what a set point is. A value of a variable that is desired. The normal value, in other words. Well, if no matter what you set the temperature for on the thermostat, the room is almost never exactly at that temperature, right? It's going to be either slightly above or slightly below almost all the time because it's going to go up and down. Only when it's right on set point is it right. Is there no difference between the variable, the actual current value, what the temperature is right now, and what you want it to be, the set point? Usually there's a difference between the two, right? A difference between the set point and the actual value of the variable. Usually there is a difference. We call that difference an error. It's an error because you want it to be at the set point, and usually it's not, at least slightly not. All right? That's true for physiology as well. Your body sets a set point for body temperature. And the body temperature is almost never exactly at that set point. It's usually slightly above or slightly below, meaning there's an error usually. But notice that an error can occur in either of two directions. Right? In the room temperature example, the room can be either too warm or too cool. Each one of those is an error. They're just in different directions. But in both of those examples, either too high or too low, to maintain thermostasis, to keep the temperature where you want it to be, you want to, at all times, reduce the error, right? If it's too high, you want to bring the temperature down. That would reduce the error because it's getting the two values closer to each other. If it's too low, you also want to reduce the error, but you do it by bringing it up so that the difference between the two is small. In other words, what you're trying to do by setting a thermostat is to negate the error. To negate means to get rid of. And that's exactly why the feedback mechanism that does that, that negates the error, is called negative feedback. Negative is just the adjective of negate. And that's why negative feedback mechanisms are the only ones that can lead to homeostasis. Okay? A negative feedback mechanism always makes the error smaller. A positive feedback mechanism is just the opposite. It will make the error, whatever it is, bigger. So if the temperature is too high, if it's above set point, a positive feedback mechanism would heat it up and make that error even bigger. Just the opposite for too low. It would make it even lower, and the error would get bigger and bigger. That's making things worse as far as the set point is concerned, right? So the vast majority of feedback mechanisms in organisms are negative feedback mechanisms because those lead to homeostasis. There are some somewhat normal positive feedback mechanisms, and the one that almost all textbooks give, even though it's not the only example, is parturition, childbirth. All positive feedback mechanisms are temporary because they can't lead to homeostasis. So they have to be temporary either because they kill you or because you'll survive that temporary positive feedback mechanism, and then negative feedback mechanisms will come into play and restore homeostasis. But for the parturition example, to illustrate why it's positive feedback, what happens during labor is that the fetus, which is usually upside down from our point of view in the uterus, has the head stretching the cervix, the narrow neck of the uterus. Well, neurons in the wall of the uterus sense that stretching, send signals to the brain, tell the brain to release oxytocin, a hormone, into the bloodstream. The whole body receives, since the whole body is served with blood, receives that oxytocin. But almost all of the body just ignores it because a hormone doesn't have any effect unless there's a receptor to receive it. So they just don't, the rest of the body doesn't know the oxytocin's there, but the uterus has receptors for that oxytocin, so it gets the signal. And that signal causes the uterus on the upper part, the blind end where the feet are, to contract, squeezing that fetus a little farther down toward the vagina. That makes the head get pushed farther into the narrow cervix, which stretches it even more, sending an even stronger signal to the brain, which responds by releasing even more oxytocin, which goes back to the uterus and causes it to squeeze even more. So you see that it keeps building. The error, in a sense, gets worse and worse. And if everything goes right, the kid pops out and the woman survives. Not always. And that has killed a lot of women throughout history, and it's happening again, sadly. But anyway, that's a positive feedback mechanism. As soon as the endoparasite is ejected, negative feedback mechanisms will come into play and restore homeostasis. If you want to think about a pathological one, you know, if I get a limb cut off in a sword fight, which would probably happen because I'm not a sword fighter, I would, you know, there would be a lot of blood gushing out, which of course would reduce my blood pressure well below normal since I'm leaking. Well, my body would respond by increasing the force of contraction of my heart and the heart rate to try to get that blood pressure back up. Well, that's just going to make the problem worse because it's going to gush out even more blood, right? And so it would keep building that way. And that would also be temporary because it would kill me or someone would have to intervene. Okay. 10. Well, this figure shows you groupings of organisms. This is a classification scheme. And this one uses animals as an example, but, I shouldn't say only animals, but it uses the bear as the example that's in each one of these taxa. Now, taxa, T-A-X-A, is the plural of taxon, which is a general word that simply means a group. And so species is a taxon, genus is a taxon, family is a taxon, and so on. And you probably have heard of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species before. Maybe not, but those are groups. This is also a hierarchy. Each big group contains some number of smaller groups within it, each of which then contains smaller groups or taxa within it, and so on. Well, I first was introduced to classification, I think maybe fifth grade or something like that. And back then, almost 50 years ago, the biggest taxa were the kingdoms. And there were five at the time, five kingdoms. Originally, there were only two kingdoms. We've been classifying organisms for thousands of years. Originally, we came up with just two groups. Plants and animals, because that's really all we noticed. We didn't have microscopic ability. We just lumped fungi in with plants, even though they're more similar to us animals. Anyway, those were the two biggies, kingdoms. And there were only two. There's nothing bigger than kingdoms. By the time it got around to my age fifth grade, there were five kingdoms, but kingdoms were still the biggest groups. Nowadays, there are many more than five kingdoms, and kingdoms aren't even the biggest taxa anymore. There are even bigger groups, and those are domains. So domains are the broadest, in other words, the most inclusive taxa, because each domain includes more things than any other taxon. Each domain contains kingdoms, each kingdom contains phyla, and so on. Notice that the smallest two are genus and species. Those are separate taxa. A genus includes a certain number of species within it. Species is smaller. It's within genus. But those two are often mentioned together in what we call a scientific binomial. Nomial just means of a name. So a binomial means using two names. A binomial is the so-called scientific name for an organism. For instance, for us, it's Homo sapiens, right? Sapiens is the name for the species. Homo is the name for the genus. So, We are the only still existing or extant species within Homo, but there have been other species within Homo. They've all gone extinct, and we're getting close to going extinct. But anyway, those are different levels. Homo and then sapiens is our species. Okay. Oh, let me just say that when you use a binomial, you always capitalize the genus name. You never capitalize the species name. And you always italicize both. Whereas the names for other taxa, you don't italicize to show you that it's bigger than genus and species. For instance, we're chordates. Well, chordata, you would not italicize. Yeah.
Is taxon already plural?
Taxon is singular. Taxa is the plural of taxon.
Oh.
Just like phyla is the plural of phylum. Now, we're on slide 11. I just told you that the domains are the largest taxa, at least for now, until we rearrange things maybe later. But not only is that true, but there are only three domains. So every organism alive now and that has ever existed in roughly 4 billion years of evolution of life belongs to one and only one of the three domains. I say only one because these are non-overlapping domains. Any given organism is a member of just one, not the others. And you can see them listed here. Bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. The three domains. And it's pretty easy to guess what are in the domain called bacteria. They are the bacteria. All of the bacteria make up the domain bacteria, and there aren't bacteria in any other domain. So the domain bacteria is made up of bacteria and only bacteria and all of the bacteria. Now, I've already told you today, earlier, that bacteria are prokaryotic cells, right? So there's a dichotomy, meaning a two-part scheme in terms of cell types. Cells are either prokaryotic or eukaryotic. But those don't match up to domains. Notice that there is a domain called eukarya, because it's named after organisms that have eukaryotic cells. The eukaryotes of the world, including us, are all in the domain eukarya, and that's the only thing that you find in there, eukaryotic organisms. But notice that there's not a domain called prokarya. So if you're not a member of eukarya, which means if you're not a eukaryote, then you have to be a prokaryote. That's the only types of organisms in terms of cell types. But that doesn't tell you what domain you're in. It just tells you that you're not in eukarya. In other words, the prokaryotic organisms of the world are split into two domains, the other two, which are bacteria and archaea. That means that all of the archaeans, which is the word for members of archaea, the domain, are also prokaryotic. So they don't have any membrane-bounded organelles, just like bacteria don't. They are also unicellular, like I said, prokaryotic cells are. And if you were to bother to look at them under a light microscope alongside a bacterium, you would be hard-pressed to tell me what the difference is. So outwardly, to us, they look very similar, but there are very important molecular differences that tell us they actually had a different origin evolutionarily compared to bacteria. Okay? So collectively, bacteria and archaea make up the prokaryotes of the world, but those are two different domains. And all of the eukaryotes of the world that have ever existed make up eukarya, the third domain. 12. Well, we talked just a little bit about evolution and natural selection. Here we're looking at two cilia, which is the plural of cilium, which means hair, but that just means they look like hairs. They're not actually true hairs. Only mammals make true hair. But some cells are ciliated, meaning they have these little projections from their surface that look like hairs, but are called cilia. And that's true in your own body, for instance. On the right, we see cilia of windpipe cells. Cells lining the trachea are ciliated. And the pink version on the left is a cilium from a paramecium, which is a unicellular eukaryote. So that's not a very close relative to us, right? A paramecium and a human are pretty drastically different types of organisms. Now, of course, if you go back far enough, everything is related because we all came from those original successful cells, like I've been saying. But these are pretty distantly related organisms. Despite that fact, though, the cilia in these drastically different organisms are structurally almost identical. And that is one of the pieces of evidence that we use to demonstrate that we come from a common ancestor. The things that were successful early on, that got naturally selected for very early on, billions of years ago, are still in the modern versions of the descendants of those groups after they split into different species and bigger groups. You see what I'm saying there? And some things are so successful that they really don't change much over time, because in order for there to be changes, there has to be random errors called mutations in DNA. And not only does that have to happen, but it has to happen that the error actually ends up being a better version than the original. Well, sometimes there's very slow evolution for structures simply because it works really well already, and any variation on that is likely going to be selected against by natural selection. Okay, 13. Another glimpse at natural selection is shown here. This is a real-world example, but in cartoon form here. There's no limit to the number of examples of natural selection. We see it all the time. But this one is nice and easy to understand for us visual animals. Here we have two populations, a prey population, which are the insects, and a predator population, the birds. And just like any naturally occurring population, the individuals that make up that population are not identical. They have at least minor differences in their traits. We talked about this a little bit last time, right? Well, that can be traits for anything, but here the example that we care about is the trait of coloration. So some of these individuals in this population are light-colored and some are darker-colored. And notice that the background, which is where they live, in this case, is dark. So the predator, the bird, wants to eat as many of these things as possible so it can have enough energy to survive and hopefully pass on its own genes, right? Really, it's not thinking about any of that. It just wants to eat. But it doesn't want to waste energy looking for food. So it's not that it prefers a dark one or a light one. It just wants to eat bugs. And to do that as efficiently as possible, it's going to snatch up the ones that are easiest to see against the background, right? So that means, since this is a dark environment, the individuals that, because of their genetic hand that they were dealt, are light-colored are going to be at a disadvantage. They stand out from the background, and those are the ones the birds easily see. So those are the ones that get eaten, right? If you get eaten, you're dead, and you're not going to pass on your genes for light-coloredness, right? That's selection against being light. The ones that are dark, yes, some of them are going to be seen and eaten, But just statistically, it's going to be more likely that the dark ones are going to live long enough by not being eaten so that they can pass on to the next generation genes for darkness. And therefore, the next generation is going to be made up of a higher percentage of dark individuals than light individuals. The population is getting better adapted to living in dark conditions. That's natural selection. And this happened in a famous example caused by the Industrial Revolution. Before the Industrial Revolution, things weren't nearly as dirty because we weren't burning coal and things like that. So it was just the opposite of this. Bugs that lived on trees had a light background, so it was favorable to be light colored. The dark ones stood out, and those are the ones that got eaten. So most of the population was light-colored. But then the Industrial Revolution came along. We started burning all the coal. This was in England, I think. And it got so sooty that it blackened the bark. And so the environment changed. Well, when the environment changes, the selection changes, right? Now all of a sudden, the dark-colored ones, which used to have the disadvantage, were the ones that could hide. And so by natural selection, over a few generations, most of them were dark-colored instead of light-colored. That's natural selection. 14, I don't want to spend too much time on. This is an example. This tree-like structure is called a phylogenetic tree. Phylogeny, which phylogenetic is the adjective of, is a system of classification. We've had all kinds of different classification schemes to put organisms into boxes over the centuries. But phylogeny is the modern way of grouping organisms together. It doesn't really matter how they look to us, which is how we based things before, which is why fungi would get lumped in with plants, even though they're drastically different. Instead, phylogeny is based on common ancestry by tracing the DNA, how it gets passed on. So the common ancestor here, this tree, by the way, which is just for these finches, is really just a tiny part of the overall tree of life. You could draw a very, very complex overall tree of life that itself would have one common ancestor, like the trunk of the tree, which would be that first successful lineage of cells that we all came from. But you can also focus on just one little piece of the branches where one group of organisms is. And every bifurcation or split here represents creation of new species by populations diverging. That's a 182 thing, though, so I'll let you study that in 182. I think 15 is the last slide in this chapter. This has to do with the scientific method. And you almost certainly learned about the scientific method before. Am I right about that? Usually you're given steps in the scientific method as though scientists are using a checklist to make sure they go through the steps correctly. That's not really what happens. But there are steps to the scientific process. It's all driven by the fact that we are curious organisms, and therefore we make observations all the time. We just notice things about the world. And since we are curious, we don't just say, that's the way things are. We wonder why those things are true. We wonder why things are the way they are. So observations naturally lead in us to questions. It's part of the process. Okay? Well, questions then want to be answered, obviously. Questions imply that there should be explanations. And that's what a hypothesis is. I know that a lot of students confuse these next two things, hypotheses and predictions. I see instructors get this wrong all the time, too. A hypothesis and a prediction are not the same thing. A hypothesis is an explanation. So linguistically, a hypothesis is a declarative sentence. In other words, a hypothesis says things are this way because such and such. The hypothesis is written in such a way that it pretends that it's true, even though it might not be true at all. It explains something, though. It doesn't predict anything. It says this is why this is true. A prediction, on the other hand, linguistically, will be written in language that includes things like if and then or will, right? Those are predictions. But they're related because a hypothesis which explains an observation or explains a question that comes from an observation, a hypothesis naturally leads to predictions. Okay, so I just told you that a hypothesis is said in such a way as though it's true. Well, a prediction is something that will happen if that hypothesis actually is true. So you have to have the hypothesis first to make the prediction based on that hypothesis. And that's exactly where the science comes in. Because a prediction says this will happen if this hypothesis is true. Therefore, let's put this to the test and see if it actually does come true. That's what an experiment is. An experiment is a way to test whether a prediction that corresponds to a hypothesis will come true. And this is a very simple example to illustrate that. The observation here is that the flashlight doesn't work. Right? So the person is saying, why? Well, there's not just two possible hypotheses, but two are given here. There's any number of hypotheses. Remember, though, that every individual hypothesis explains it as though it were true. So the first hypothesis is you have dead cells, a battery of cells, right? The other is, well, the bulb is burned out. Each of those leads individually, naturally, logically, to a prediction. The prediction for the dead batteries is if you change the batteries with fresh ones, it will light up again. That's a prediction, right? Linguistically, you notice that. And the other one is if you change the bulb with a fresh one, it will light up again. Well, then you actually go ahead with the actual test. That's the experimentation part. If you do that, and the prediction does not come true, that tells you, and this is the whole basis of science, this is how we have knowledge, that tells you that that particular hypothesis is wrong because it didn't come true. It's at least partially wrong. Now, it might be that you kind of got close with that explanation. You have to just adjust it and then retest the new hypothesis, or it could just be flat out wrong. And that's not a problem. Disconfirming or falsifying hypotheses is valuable scientific information, and we do this all the time. So it's not a failure of the experiment if a prediction doesn't come true. It's valuable because it tells you that hypothesis is not true. What happens, though, if the prediction comes true? What does that tell you? Like if on the other one, change the bulb out and it lights up again. Prediction came true. So what does that tell you?
The hypothesis was correct.
No, it tells you that your hypothesis could be correct. Now, just to use this example again, maybe there was just a discontinuity in the wire, a loose wire. And in the process of opening it up, you changed a working bulb with another working bulb, but just happened to put that wire back in the right place. Now you're fooled into thinking that it's true, right? So no, a prediction coming true doesn't tell you that the hypothesis is right. We don't ever really prove hypotheses. We just get closer and closer to demonstrating that they're probably true. And those things that we test over and over and that always comes true, we eventually call those things facts, like gravity and evolution by natural selection. You know, those are facts. And what we call facts scientifically changes because every so often we actually test things in a different way and say, we weren't right about this. For instance, Newtonian mechanics, how things move in the universe, is pretty close to the truth, but we realize when we get to the microscopic scale that it's not right. The math breaks down. We still teach Newtonian mechanics in physics classes because it's easier to learn than what we've replaced that with. But it's no longer... That's an essence of science. We have to replace what's proven to be incorrect with a replacement. This brings up the fundamental difference between faith and science. Two totally different ways of looking at the world. Science is based on evidence. Without evidence, there is no science. And so the things that we call facts are based on evidence. It's not just someone thinking this could be true and it makes sense for it to be true. You have to demonstrate it. Faith, on the other hand, is belief regardless of there being evidence. And in fact, sometimes belief in something despite evidence to the contrary. So in other words, faith is believing something simply because you want to believe it. That's not scientific. And you can, if you're operating by faith, you can keep believing regardless of what happens. Well, that's not true for science. You can't say, as a scientist, Newtonian mechanics is true. We've demonstrated that it's not. So we have to change the truth, and we're doing this all the time. We never really know anything for sure, but we get closer and closer, and that's why it's reasonable to believe those things. That is a chapter. Let me transition now to the next one.